listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
In our weekly look at things around the Caribbean and Latin America, we discussed with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, an election this past weekend in El Salvador, and the ongoing situation in Venezuela. It was a bit of a surprise in the outcome of that election in El Salvador, right?
The election in El Salvador was a surprise in the sense that the guy that won, Bukele, Nayib Bukele, he won with 53% of the vote. That is kind of, and over the last six elections since the end of the effective dictatorship in El Salvador in the early 90s. And this is the first election, really, in which there's been such a clear win, and such a clear win for somebody that is neither of the two historic parties. There have always been antagonists in El Salvador. Right. The progressive Frente Furibundo Martí party, the FMLN, and the extreme right-wing party originally founded by Desquad leader Roberto de Aubuisson, called ARENA.
Right.
And over the last five or six elections, it's always been those two parties that have slogged it out. In the previous two elections, the FMLN won, but not by much. And in this election, all that kind of format, that schema of political configuration has been completely broken by this victory by Nayib Bukele. Now, who is, and I don't feel optimistic at all about the election result, because I see that very much in the same mold as Jimmy Morales and to some extent Jair Bolsonaro and Mauricio Macri in Brazil and Argentina, respectively, because Bukele won on this phony platform, an anti-corruption platform, when he's his right-wing backers, because he's a his Ghana electoral front was basically a centre-right political movement. And he's backed by right-wing business people in particular, who was corrupt as hell. So it was ridiculous of voters to swallow the anti-corruption line, but that's what happens, isn't it? And that's what happened in Brazil with Bolsonaro. It's what happened in Guatemala with Morales. It's what happened in Ecuador with Moreno, and so on and on and on. And it's always the same. The voters get hit with an extremely slick, but also extremely superficial media propaganda campaign on behalf of this, in this case, a young, personable candidate who was mayor of San Salvador and was not an unsuccessful mayor during his tenure as mayor of San Salvador, but nor was he especially successful. So and that's one reason why he did well. But what I found somewhat disturbing was the extent to which the FMLN failed, because I thought that they'd at least get over 20% of the votes and maybe even get into a possible runoff. But nothing like that happened. I was completely wrong about that. They slumped to something like just under 14% of the vote, which is unheard of in El Salvador. They've always got well over 20%, unless I'm misremembering.
And you know, he was mayor of two different municipalities, in the latest at San Salvador, as FMLN party member and candidate. And then he was basically kicked out for wrecking it, promoting internal division and defamatory acts against the party.
Absolutely. He was a very, very divisive figure. And also, he's far from squeaky clean himself, and he's just been very good at covering his tracks. So, it is quite disturbing that Salvadoran voters should have turned their backs so categorically on the FMLN party, which is the only party of the three that had well thought out policies to benefit the impoverished majority in El Salvador. It's just baffling how it could be that they slumped to such a low portion of the vote, but that's what happened. What we'll see is what we've seen in Argentina and Guatemala all these other places where similar figures to Bukele have won.
Yep.
And they'll betray their election promises. They'll promote neoliberal policies. They'll side in the international arena. It's very bad news for progressive governments, because Bukele is certain to line up as yet another puppet of the U.S. authorities, in for example, in votes in the OAS,
right,
and elsewhere.
That's going to be interesting. His campaign, apparently, the question of wait a minute, your politics or FMLN, what are you doing with Ghana, which is a right wing, center right, whatever, but a right wing party. And his campaign said essentially, look, they're the only other existing party where I could run to be, for a presidential campaign. My politics have not changed. And so now, of course, we're going to see, here's a foreign policy decision to make. Do we support the United States at the OAS or Venezuela? The proof is going to be in the pudding.
Yeah, I might be wrong about Bukele's position vis-a-vis Venezuela, but I doubt very much. He ran on a centre-right ticket.
Yes, he did.
And he can lie and try and fool people as much as he likes about what his real politics were. But he's a centre-right social democrat, and that's why the FMLN threw him out, because he was trying to change their policies in favor of people at grassroots.
Lenny Moreno could run as a leftist and govern as a right winger. So I assume you could run as a right winger and govern as one without too many questions.
And it's that oldest ploy in kind of centrist politics, isn't it? Faint left, go right, and it works every time.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yep. So
So then, you know, and that maybe we should start talking about Venezuela in that context, because it's like, and maybe I'm wrong about Bukele, and maybe he will at least abstain in votes in the OAS and the United Nations, but I doubt it. He and his circle are going to cave in to U.S. pressure.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and El Salvador going that way, of course, is not great news for Nicaragua either.
No.
It's another neighboring country to look over your shoulder at.
Yeah, and Nicaragua has been scrupulous about not interfering in the internal affairs of its neighbors, either in Honduras or Guatemala or Costa Rica.
Right.
And certainly not in El Salvador. And they've always maintained very cordial relations with their northern neighbors. It's been Costa Rica that's been the country that's constantly trying to interfere in Nicaragua's internal affairs. But as the U.S. offensive against Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua, and next, of course, will be Bolivia, and we'll see that later in the year.
Right.
As that offensive intensifies, the pressure on phonies like Bukele to toe the U.S. Diplomatic line will be intense, and he is not going to resist it.
Right. Well, we shall see. Yeah, so, all right, Venezuela. Well, since we last spoke, this past weekend, I don't know, it looked, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people gathered on Saturdays to support President Maduro and the government. There were opposition rallies, but looking at the aerial photography, which was, there was an extensive documentation of who had how many people where. I would say that it was like 10 to 1, the turnout for the government. If you're looking at this being decided in the street, it may well have been decided this past weekend. Now, President Maduro spoke for an hour. He was very confident. He was very well received. And he threw the ball back at the opposition in a very clever way, I thought. And I think also a very intelligent, you know, an honest thing, something that would be constructive. He said, yeah, you guys want to have a new election. It shouldn't be for president. We just had a presidential election. But we have this National Assembly that's in this state. It's legally frozen. It's politically, you know, at least in an ambiguous state. You're trying to spring a president from this. Why don't we have new elections for the National Assembly and then move forward from there? And that's what he put out on Saturday, and hasn't been much spoken about that here.
No, and I should imagine that the corporate media, the international corporate media, will completely quash that. They won't give it any. Sorry, Don. Big truck going by.
So it sounded like the army's landing. They didn't want to hear that.
Yeah, and the international corporate media are certainly going to quash that news, because it shows, as you say, it shows that Nicolas Maduro is prepared to go to an election. It may be not the election that the opposition won, but then the thing is that you now have the European Union countries, although not as the European Union, because that was vetoed by Italy and Greece, apparently.
That's right, yep.
A large number of the Western European countries, more than anything, recognizing Guaido as what they call an interim president, which doesn't even figure in the Venezuelan constitution. It's nonsense in legal terms. And what they'll say, and what the United States will say, and what the Venezuelan opposition will say, well, we can't have elections unless they're run by the United Nations.
Right.
And like in Haiti, right?
Right.
Where in election after election in run by the United Nations, they've been a complete farce.
Yeah.
So, and I don't see. I'm very pessimistic about the situation in Venezuela from one point of view, and optimistic from another point of view. And I think the agenda that's being generated by the United States and its supine European allies, and you can more or less write off the Venezuelan opposition as having any say at all in the process,
right,
as they just do what they're told.
Right.
The agenda that's being generated leaves no room for anything but military intervention.
Which I don't think is going to—it's almost impossible to win it that way, given, you know, it's no accident that the United States did not invade Cuba after the Bay of Pigs. Aside from the Soviet, guarantee of its security, quote-unquote, and the promise not to invade, which, of course, that, of course, would restrain the U.S. from going after something that it wants, the fact of it was that the development of the people as a resistance force, as a military resistance force, the committees for the defense of the revolution, the entire organization of the society as a people's army, in essence, that was the thing. Going in there, you're fighting until the last Cuban is dead, basically. That's the only way that you conquer Cuba under those conditions. And, you know, Hugo Chavez came from the military, was very close to the military, brought the military to the people and the people to the military, and he was with the Cubans from pretty much the beginning of his time in office. And so I can't, and not only that, by the way, there's the example of the coup being undone by the people.
Right.
So
yeah,
I don't think a military intrusion into Venezuela turns out well for the invaders at all.
Well, no, I was going to go on and say, and I think I agree with everything that you said. I was going to go on and say that is why the United, and my opinion, for what that's worth, that is why the United States is bound to fail. And in our last conversation,
Agreed.
I put it to you that the only question is what kind of the defeat the United States is going to suffer this time. And I still think that, because if you look at the internal situation, Nicolas Maduro did an interview with a Spanish reporter the other day, and the Spanish reporter was quoted as saying, I thought this was quite interesting, actually.
Yeah.
He was quoted as saying, he was completely struck by the total calmness and serenity of Nicolas Maduro and everybody in the government that this Spanish TV reporter met. And his take on that was, well, either we've been fed completely false information about the internal situation in Venezuela, or they are completely isolated from the people. That was his conclusion. Now, we know from the events on Saturday that it's ridiculous to claim that Nicolas Maduro and his government are isolated from the people. And so that leaves us with what you and I know already, that the information that this Spanish reporter had been going on in his attempt to understand what's happening in Venezuela is all completely false.
Right. Yep.
Right?
Yep. So it makes sense,
then,
though.
So what do you have there? You have this categorically unquestionable reality in Venezuela of a substantial minority, but still a minority in the opposition, that are determined to be recalcitrant and refuse to negotiate or recognize the constitutional government of Nicolas Maduro, and they have bet on foreign intervention to get them what they want. But against that, you have a solid majority of people in Venezuela who actually support their constitution, do not want foreign intervention. I think the figure in a recent poll was 80%.
80+%, yeah.
Yeah. And that is the reality. And you have the reality whereby the government, okay, so what has the U.S. government done? It's imposed all these sanctions that up until now the Venezuelan government has managed to counter more or less successfully. You know, obviously with all kinds of problems, but they're coping. And so what the United States has done is it's impounded Citgo, which has something like $7 billion of assets.
Right.
But that doesn't have an immediate effect on Venezuela's economy. And what the Venezuelans have said is, Well, if you want any oil, you're going to have to pay for it in advance.
Right.
So what that means is that unless the United States is going to start sanctioning its own oil companies to stop buying oil from Venezuela, they're going to find that they don't have any oil to refine in all those Citgo refineries that they just impounded.
Yep.
So, you know, and it's just...
And, you know, and this again, this is happening. This is, I'm sorry, but this is happening again as we come into a term where OPEC is going to be chaired by Venezuela.
Right. Right. And so, and there's all that. Okay. So, and Venezuela is going to start selling its oil elsewhere. The United States is going to find that it doesn't have the oil that it's been accustomed to having to supply its East Coast refineries. Citgo, in effect, is going to be a burden, not an asset.
Right.
And although it's true that something like $11 billion in is the phrase upstream value from Citgo's activities over the next few years. Yeah. That's what the United States reckoned they were hitting Venezuela with.
Right.
Well, and that all the Venezuelans are going to do is work out other strategies for dealing with this crisis.
Right.
Well, and that's what's going to happen. They're going to be supported by Russia and China. So what is the United States then going to do? What they're talking about at the moment is trying to institute some kind of humanitarian corridor. Yeah. Well, the only way they can do that is by a military intervention. So there's some military activity in the area near Cucuta, down there on the border, on Venezuela's border on the Colombian side.
And this would be in the face of the UN, by the way. Guterres said last week that humanitarian aid that comes through the UN goes to the government, which is headed by President Nicolas Maduro.
No responsible humanitarian organization is going to give humanitarian aid to a character like Guaido who controls no territory and has no infrastructure for distribution of the aid, or certainly no trustworthy infrastructure. So that and all that, it's like a theater of the absurd, and it's so difficult to see what's going to happen. And obviously we will see what happens, but yes. It's impossible to see any rational outcome or any rational procedure that the United States and its ridiculous European allies, I mean, they're so pathetic. It's, you know, and there aren't words to describe how pathetic the Europeans are in relation to Venezuela.
Well,
and what just they have, and somebody said, I've forgotten who it was. I think it was one of the European ministers. They said, well, we'll go along this far with the United States, but we don't see that they have any plan B. And of course they don't have any plan B, because they don't, you know, and it's just completely irrational.
Look at Syria. What was the plan B for Syria?
What's happening in Venezuela is what happened in Nicaragua last year, but on a much larger scale. And what happened is that the United States thought that with a huff and puff, they'd blow everything down.
Right.
Well, it didn't work.
Didn't work.
And they seem to be operating on the same logic in Venezuela. They've huffed and they've puffed. And the Venezuelan government is still there. And Venezuelan society is still functioning. And the Venezuelan economy is still functioning. So what are they going to do now?
Now, here's something else, too. To me, this is and I mentioned this in another interview that I had earlier today, but we'll discuss later. Okay, so the social fabric in Venezuela is stratified, heavily stratified according to class, historically, and a very strong, almost to a person, identification with race and or indigenous status. The white folks that were descended from the Spanish are the upper middle class, and a couple of them among them are the actual elite. And then folks of African heritage and indigenous heritage here are the workers and the very, very poor. And that is not uncommon for the entire region, certainly, but
It's very strongly rooted there. The Bolivarian Revolution did huge, progress to remediating a lot of that. You know, when you talk about building 2.5 million housing units, for example, it helped to remedy the imbalance in housing distribution between those two groups of people. Almost all of the other things, healthcare, education, electricity, etc., that rides along that. Now, you have a situation where the government, the constitution developed by these people, the government elected by these people, is taken away from them by the Europeans. Now, let's talk about which Europeans they are. Spain, Portugal, UK, France, Belgium, the Netherlands. These are the colonial powers that were here raping and pillaging for the first few hundred years here. They just left. Some of them still haven't left. And now they're going to say who should be president of Venezuela. To half the population of Venezuela, that looks very bad. The optics, that's the term they like to use at the times. Real bad optics. And now take a look around the neighborhood. What do you think goes through the minds of the people in Brazil, which is also evenly divided along similar lines?
And the army in Brazil have already told Bolsonaro that they're not interested in intervening in Venezuela. Yeah. But there's a political electoral statistic that is also relevant, Don. I think what you've just said is extremely relevant and all too easy to forget. But I'm going back to kind of more Eurocentric way of looking at things. And in terms of, in electoral terms, there was a study by the very, very well-trusted Hinterlaces organization, polling company that's trusted by both sides. And Hinterlaces came out with a poll just the other day in which they said, you remember we were saying last week, or I was suggesting last week that there was something like 30-35% for the Chavistas and something like 20-25% for the opposition. Well, it was very interesting that Hinterlaces actually bore out that view, which is in any case based on the polling, previous polling in previous years by companies like Hinterlaces. They put 19% as outright supporting the opposition, 33% outright supporting Chavismo.
Right.
And the remainder kind of floating. So what you've got is something like 48% floating.
Right.
Now, if you go back to what we were saying last week about, you know, in any election there's 15% that don't vote.
Right.
Well, that would probably leave, assuming that the 19% opposition all turn out, 33% Chavistas all turn out, 15% don't vote. Let's say that leaves 33% of the 48% voters.
Right.
So the Chavismo would only need kind of a third of those, or a little more than
third. That's right.
In order to win.
That's right.
And that is why, in the last presidential election, the right-wing opposition didn't take part because they knew they'd lose. They knew they'd lose, and their strategy was to try and delegitimize the election by boycotting it, because they knew they'd lose.
Yep.
And going back to what you said earlier about the parliamentary the proposal by Nicolas Maduro to bring forward the parliamentary elections.
Right.
In fact, I don't think it was Maduro that proposed it. I think it was a proposal that came out of the Constituent Assembly. And Maduro seconded it.
By seconding it, it's like, oh, by the way, as the president of Venezuela, why don't we do, I'm saying to you guys, why don't we do this? I didn't mean to make it sound like it was his.
That constituent assembly is more powerful than the president.
That's right, absolutely, yep.
Right, because they are the literally the voice of the people, and they
literally
decide what's going to happen.
Yep, literally.
And that, of course, is why the Europeans and the United States stay completely quiet about the constituents.
Yeah. You don't want anybody getting ideas about having those things, like, say, in Paris, for example, right now.
Right, yeah, sure. As if. Anyway, so what that all means is that the chances of the opposition agreeing to bring forward the parliamentary elections are zero.
Right.
Because they know they'll lose.
Right.
At the moment. So what? And I think what's likely to happen is, because President Trump is so volatile, and he'll, you know, he'll turn around and say, well, night is day today, but and then a week later he'll say, oh no, I got that wrong, day is night, and he'll. Right. That's what he'll do. He's likely to do with Venezuela. So we've got all this huffing and puffing about Venezuela. That'll. And my feeling is, I hope I'm right, because a military intervention, as you said, would be just absolutely catastrophic. My feeling is that the United States won't go for a military intervention. That they'll do one of these turnarounds that Donald Trump is a kind of a maestro pulling off. And things will just chunter along at a relatively low level while the United States waits for conditions in which it will be possible for their opposition to win an election. And in the meantime, they'll just try and sustain constant instability through their puppet Guaido.
Right.
I agree. My feeling is that is how it's going to go, because I don't think even the United States wants a military intervention. I mean, even crazy people, manic sadists like John Bolton and Elliot Abrams.
Yeah.
And I think even they are going to have to face the reality that it will not do them any good.
Here's what I think in addition to that. I agree completely. There's a domestic side to it also. You've had since Trump's election and this like faux left, inciting a faux revolution, you know, et cetera. So, and those who are actually, you know, interested in seeing an actual revolution in the United States have never had anywhere to go before. So there's some cohesion between those two groups. Even though there are so many contradictions, obviously, such as having CIA on your side as you make revolution. But if the U.S. were to have a bipartisan invasion of Venezuela, because I don't see Schumer and Pelosi walking away from this. There's going to be a split in what they thought was going to be a united front. And that little kernel could change the nature of the revolution in the United States. And we're out of time, Tony. Right. Thanks a lot.
Well, let's hope you're right, Don.
We'll see.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle. The U.S. intel community and the political establishment challenged Trump's foreign policy. Is this a good or bad thing? Also, forced regime change in Venezuela continues apace. Crosstalking some real news, I'm joined by my guest here in Moscow, Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. We also have Viktor Olevich. He's a political analyst as well as a leading expert at the Center for Actual Politics. And, of course, we have Dmitry Bobich. He's a political analyst with Sputnik International. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want. Let me just kind of introduce this program here. Looking at the front page, some of the headlines from antiwar.com. Trump insists on Afghanistan withdrawal. Senate votes to stay in Syria, Afghanistan. Pentagon continues to resist Syria pullout. Kurdish lobby struggles to slow U.S. pullout from Syria. Viktor, we've had the imperial presidency for decades now, and it's a product of the Cold War. But, you know, through time, the president has been given prerogatives, privileges, without much oversight. Now we see the complete reverse. We're essentially denying Donald Trump as president of the United States to have a foreign policy. Now, on this program, we've discussed the pros and cons of his foreign policy, but now he doesn't even look like he's being denied it, and very forcefully, including his own party.
Well, this is very symptomatic, Peter, of what of the loyalties and disloyalties, both in the U.S. Congress, in the U.S. intelligence community, in the Pentagon. And this is a taste of things to come. When that attempt to remove Trump is going to actually happen, and it is likely to happen after the final report, after Mueller's final report comes out, then we will see the same forces, the same political forces that are now trying to impede Trump's foreign policy agenda come out against him in force to try to remove him from his
post. We have to make it very clear. They're not impeding him having a coup d'etat openly in Venezuela.
Of course.
Okay. You know, Mark, I think you all saw the American Conservative an article. Trump is right. The intelligence community needs to go back to school. Now, let me read a quick paragraph of it because I think it's brilliant here. The current crop of national intelligence chiefs are cut from the same cloth as their predecessors. They are careerists who have risen to the top, not through their analytical or operational talents, but through their willingness to conform to a system that is designed not to challenge conventional thinking.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's obviously true. It's been true for several administrations now, going at least back to the George W. Bush administration, probably. I think we can take it even further back, all the way to Reagan and so on. But, I mean, Gina Haspel, a hands-on torturer, is now director of the CIA. So much for accountability. Clapper and Brennan during the Obama era both lied under oath to Congress and the Senate, to the House and the Senate.
But didn't Roger Stone as well?
There were no repercussions. No repercussions for them. So, the same people have been elevated in the Trump administration to these positions. Gina Haspel is just one example at the CIA, and Pompeo becoming Secretary of State, Dan Coats. They're all ripped from the same page. A lot of them have prior military experience and experience within what I think we Ben Rhodes called the blob. Mm-hmm. He identified the blob during the Obama administration as the both the commentariat and the appointed bureaucracy, the deep state, if you will, that is unelected and that formulates U.S. foreign policy and has repeatedly formulated a policy of hegemony and regime change that has failed again and again.
So, Mr. Ideology. So it's really all about ideology here because it has nothing to do with political parties.
Well, okay. I mean, coming back to the conventional wisdom, what does it mean, conventional wisdom? Let's be blunt. Conventional wisdom means war. They want to make sure war happens or is very possible. I mean, Mr. Trump leaves the INF Treaty. Initially, there were some protests inside the United States in the European Union. Then they realized that it was actually bringing the war closer. So suddenly, all the foreign ministers of the EU come out with a statement.
It was a very rapid change.
Putting all the blame on Russia, saying that it was Russia who breached the treaty. So they are, I'm quoting, in complete agreement with the United States on basically allowing medium-range missiles target Europe, you know, from both sides. Talking about ideology, you know, a lot of people said, oh, it's all just about money. If Russia had the same stakeholders from the United States as China, things would be so much better. Well, China indeed bought $1.2 trillion worth of American securities. It didn't prevent the trade war.
Yeah.
And it didn't prevent that intelligence community that we're talking about. Now this is intelligence community is openly targeting China.
Right.
They're talking about blockading China. They're talking about limiting China's military abilities.
It's interesting like here, because what we're talking about here was this. So the briefing that was given to Congress, a worldwide threat assessment report here.
Exactly.
And the media Trump made a big deal out of it after he saw it. I suppose he saw the hearings, and then he went on some kind of Twitter rage, and you know that's where we got go back to school phrase. Then he meets them, and then he says we're all on the same page. No, they're not at all. Okay, he lost face in that, I think.
Look, there are several very serious problems that this rift between Trump and the intelligence, this open rift between Trump and the intelligence community exposes. First of all, we saw an example in the lead up to the Iraq war of how the intelligence community essentially makes up analysis that its leadership requests.
Cherry picking.
Right, and simply says what's necessary, even though the evidence isn't really there.
today we see another very serious example of a threat to democracy, a direct threat to democracy, where the intelligence community is not loyal to the commander-in-chief, not loyal to the president, and decides to promote its own agenda against the will and the viewpoint of the president. Now, we've seen, I would remind, remember about a month into Trump's presidency, Chuck Schumer came out and said that if a president, you watch, if somebody picks a fight, decides to pick a fight with the intelligence community, they have a way of getting back at that person. And there was an example with a Democrat senator in the 90s. Back then, Torricelli was a congressman, actually. He exposed U.S. Army intelligence role in killing some Guatemalan citizens during the Civil War there. What happened after that? The CIA did everything possible to malign him. Never again did Torricelli come out with any serious criticism of the U.S. intelligence community. And this is
But all the ones that cooked the books, as it were, for the illegal invasion of 2003. They're still around.
Exactly.
Elliot Abrams is gainfully employed again in the State Department.
And so this Chuck Schumer's warning, it's coming to bear right now, and it's coming to bear against Trump.
Is this political, Mark? I mean, is this a way to undermine him? Because, again, as we said with Dima here, I mean, these are people that have made it up through the ranks through two different administrations, different political parties here. I mean, is this sending a signal that you really have to get our permission to go down these paths when it comes to Iran, when it comes to Venezuela, when it comes to Russia, when it comes to China?
Sure, I think a lot of it is knee-jerk partisanship, but if you take a liberal interventionist and a neocon, they're simply flip sides of the same coin. And I have a hard time telling whether it's the blob, the intelligence community, and Congress that are lying more about foreign policy or the Trump administration at this point. Let's toss up a scorecard, all right? So we know that Trump is in favor of pulling troops out, at least rhetorically, from Syria and Afghanistan, and the blob and the Congress are in favor of a permanent war there, keeping there. In Iran, right now, at least rhetorically, the intelligence community and Congress are bucking the Trump administration by insisting that Iran is holding to the terms of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action because of the Obama-era legacy.
But is that political then?
But if the Trump administration continues on its path to sanction and drive for regime change in Iran, I don't think that that opposition will hold up, because we've already seen the Democrats in Congress support sanctions. Venezuela, though. Venezuela is where we've all, the neocons, the liberal interventionists, Democrats, Republicans,
media,
the intelligence community,
media,
the Trump admin, the media, have all found common cause. There is regime change we can all agree with, right?
You see, but this is what I've been saying, Dima. I mean, empire is the glue that keeps it all together, because it doesn't matter where you are in the political spectrum. As long as you buy in to the ideology of empire and permanent war, that's what keeps the parameters there. I mean, you can disagree about the wall, but you don't disagree on empire.
It's absolutely true. And again, you cannot explain it by money interests. It's really, it's ideology. You know, the whole world should listen to the United States and the European Union on which kind of leaders it should have. And Mr. Macron is demanding, you know, a resignation of Maduro because of people's protests. When is Macron doing that? When he is facing his own protests
we should start a movement to recognize Le Pen as the president.
The most interesting thing is that Macron now is saying that he is also a yellow vest. Just let me quote him. If being a yellow vest
Maduro
means pushing for a higher pay and for a more efficient parliament, then I'm a yellow vest.
Higher pay for himself.
The problem is that these people, you know, when dictators, when ultra-right, like Bolsonaro in Brazil, is useful, suddenly you have Democrats supporting Bolsonaro. If someone who appears to be from the left, you know, like Guaido is posing as someone who is not for the rich, you know, then they support a seemingly leftist candidate.
Yeah, we're going to talk about Venezuela in the second half here. But what do you bet, gentlemen, before we go to the break, that if the coup being constructed and directed at Venezuela, if it goes south, Trump will be blamed, right?
Of course, Trump would be blamed. It would be a major U.S. foreign policy failure that will be laid on his doorstep. But unfortunately, the U.S. intelligence community seems to have prepared very well for this coup. And it seems so far, again, unfortunately, it seems to be going their way.
Okay, hold that thought, because that's exactly what we're going to talk about when we return. After a short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, Mark, if I go back to that page from antiwar.com, there's another headline here, and this is where we'll go here. Bolton, dot, dot, intervention against Venezuela, not imminent, okay? How is the coup going? Is it on schedule?
Well, Bolton has laid out the U.S. rationale in a pretty, I think, commendable honesty.
He's a good bureaucrat. We'll give him that.
Yeah. It will make a big difference to the U.S. economically if we could have American oil companies invest in and produce the oil capabilities in Venezuela.
Very direct.
Very honest. And he went on to say, this was in an interview with Fox News, he's in a conversation with major oil companies, and they're all basically getting ready to run Venezuela's energy resources. The U.S. puppet, Pompeo calls him Guido. The U.S. puppet president in Venezuela has already said his plan to revive the Venezuelan country, the economy, is to privatize off the state oil company, which, of course, would mean handing all of it over primarily to U.S.
Is it going to be that easy, Victory?
Look, it's not going to be that fast. It's a creeping coup, and it will creep for quite a long time. There is still a long way to go. But the problem is that the United States and its allies, its partners in the region and outside, in Europe, for example, in the UK, they have been trying to cut off all the instruments, economic instruments, that Maduro, that the legitimate government of Venezuela, would be able to use to improve or change the economic situation in the country. So there are massive economic sanctions against Venezuela that are getting harsher and harsher with essentially every week and sometimes even several times a week. There are gold reserves that have now been confiscated yes. by the British Central Bank, the Bank of Britain. There are a number of other steps that have been taken. And so the danger for Maduro, the danger for the government in Caracas, is that the economic situation will get worse and worse and worse, and there is nothing they can say to the people of Venezuela to give them hope that the situation will improve eventually. Because if it only gets worse, then where is the hope that it will get better? Where would come from?
So,
and that will really negatively impact the future of Maduro.
The game plan is the worse, the better.
Exactly.
Okay. Dima.
Well, I think that the United States and the EU went one mistake, and that this is what a lot of experts say. They went too early, too fast. I mean, the decision to recognize Guaido as the legitimate president
Guido.
Of Venezuela, Guido as
Guaido, it's Guido.
I know, but
I believe
the big master, calls him Guido. So the decision to recognize Guaido as the legitimate president came from 50 countries now. And the EU gave Maduro just 8 days to hold an election. It's physically, technically impossible. So all the hardship that people will endure now in Venezuela, it can be blamed on foreign intervention, rightly blamed, simply because they went too fast,
Dima,
too early.
Dima, it's 8 days to call an election within 6 to 8 to 12 months. But that still is an absolutely illegal ultimatum.
I agree, but what is important now, I think, will Maduro try to compromise, then it's death for him.
I'm glad you asked that, because he's been saying there should be talks, there should be dialogue.
Early parliamentary
and it's only
elections.
One side that talks about dialogue, which doesn't get reported in Western media.
Of course, Guaido and Russia is also suggesting dialogue.
No, they want it all. They don't want
compromise. Of course, Guaido and those behind him, the Americans and the Europeans, they don't want any dialogue because they simply want Maduro removed and Guaido to take his place. And that's it.
There are two sides of what's happening right now. The economic and the covert. And I think The Economist, all right, weekly news magazine of the British establishment, I think, again, commendable honesty, tweeted out with an article, John Guaido, and Donald Trump are betting that sanctions will topple the regime before they starve the Venezuelan people. I mean, that lays out, you know, the impetus right there. But right now, the covert side of it, while the sanctions are going on, the CIA is doing exactly what they did so well in Iraq and Libya. They are trying to suborn, buy off, blackmail, threaten every Venezuelan military officer, National Guard officer, police chief, politician, bureaucrat. And so far, what we know is they've had only small successes. We have an Air Force general, the Venezuelan military envoy to the U.S., and I believe the Venezuelan ambassador to Iraq have defected to the U.S. puppet Guaido. But we don't know how many more are coming behind the scenes, because the bulk of that will announce at once when they may go for the final big regime change push. And this is why the U.S. didn't really have to fight in Iraq or in Libya at the end in Tripoli, because the military, the police just stood down. And this is what they're going to try to do here as well.
We'll see if it works. I would like to know the geopolitical end of it here, because there's a lot of commentary by the commentariat that this is a master move to push the Russians and the Chinese out, not only of Venezuela, but of the whole hemisphere, because we do know that Nicaragua is being targeted and Cuba again, basically making null and void the Obama outreach to Cuba.
The Wall Street Journal headline, U.S. push to oust Venezuela's Maduro marks just the first step in a plan to reshape Latin America.
It's not the first step.
Targeting Nicaragua.
No, it's good, I don't know. It's good, Mark. History will tell us which step it is. Okay,
Mark, it's good that you actually read that. Look, Argentina, Macri, who is much more pro-American than his predecessors, mm-hmm. than Kirchner, Bolsonaro in Brazil, a completely pro-American president.
Honduras, now, El Salvador.
Yes, and now Venezuela. So what are we actually seeing? We're seeing that in each Latin American country, the U.S. is using those instruments and those mechanisms that are most effective to get the government that they want installed, used. So in Argentina, in Brazil, they were able to use various political machinations, various political schemes to get their candidates through, and that worked, so that worked. In Venezuela, they were unable to use different kinds of, they tried, for years they've tried to use different political machinations, it didn't work. So now they're going for a full-fledged coup, which is what we're seeing today.
Well, talking about geopolitics, Gallup conducted a poll among Latin Americans, just like around the world also, whom do you want to trade with? And in several countries, China came first before the United States. In the countries like Peru, like Ecuador, Venezuela, of course. So it's not so easy to change the tide that has been going that way for quite a few years now. On the United States, let me be a little bit optimistic. I think that every time they make more and more mistakes, these regime changes. The problem now is that they didn't find someone from inside the ruling elite. They didn't find another Chavista who would challenge Maduro. They found someone until 2 months ago was a nobody for the huge majority of the Venezuelan people.
But this is actually a plus for the Americans because he owes everything to them.
But they walk more and more crudely, because why did they manage to topple Milosevic in Yugoslavia? They found someone who was acceptable. Kashtunica was acceptable for the nationalists and for the liberals. Later on, they forgot about Kashtunica. They threw him out. But he was useful at the moment. Now, the regime changes are working in a cruder and cruder way, and they may fail this time, just like they failed with Assad. With Assad, their problem was that they unleashed such forces against him, which were unacceptable for the Syrian people and for the Syrian elite. You know, these people, the Syrian elite, would not physically survive under the Islamists.
Yeah. Look,
Go ahead.
What really changed the balance of forces in Syria was the intervention by Russia and Iran.
Which came later, really, in 2015.
Because that's not going to happen in the case of Venezuela.
That's the big difference.
Russia and China both have made significant investments in the Venezuelan economy. And Iran has also started to make investments in the region. That's why in this Wall Street Journal piece I mentioned, they're targeting now Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Cuba. And the express intent is a Monroe doctrine rehash of driving Russian and Chinese and Iranian influence out of the region, meaning they're not allowed to do business here, at least not under, except under our terms. So, but it's simply too far, and Russia and China do not have the military power projection capabilities to put military force in any way. I mean, Syria is the very geopolitical horizon of Russian interests, and China, as much as they have invested, are not ready to engage in a firefight, not for Venezuela, despite the world's largest proven oil reserves, 300 billion barrels, being on the line.
Let me say a few words about in defense of Macri, because when Mauricio Macri won the election, everyone expected him to throw RT out. RT continues to broadcast. He did not cancel all the contracts. So there are still differences. There are still differences. But if Maduro hopes to achieve a compromise with the United States or with the EU, he's wrong. His decision to hold early parliamentary elections, if this is just to remove the joke of a parliament that they have now, completely pro-US, then it's the right decision. If he, in this way, if he hopes to appease the United States and the EU, he won't appease them.
That's what makes it really critical here, because no matter what the current government does, it will not be acceptable at all. Okay?
Exactly. They have already made a decision in Washington, in London, in the other Western capitals, that the Maduro government has to go. And unless something extraordinary happens to break their plan, like it happened in Syria, their view is not going to change.
A Venezuelan version of Maduro signing a January 21st agreement, as Yanukovych did, would be the stupidest move possible. Obviously, what the U.S. has planned for Venezuela is just like what it had planned for Ukraine in 2014, or if you go back to Chile, in 1973, with the CIA push Pinochet into power, which is, by the way, if you look at the news headlines, nearly identical playbook to what is happening right now. But it's not just removing one person. Like in Ukraine, like in Chile 1973, they need to level off the entire political field leftist socialist opposition.
They're not going
government.
To go to retirement homes, Mark. Okay, that's why it's good. The potential for violence is very high.
But we saw it in Ukraine, where the opposition was simply banned, lustrated, or suicided
and
off the
board.
Republican.
That's all the time we have here, gentlemen. Many thanks to my guests in Moscow. This is the end of our broadcast segment. Stay with us for the extended version on our YouTube channel. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.